Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. So we've talked a lot on How I Built This about AI, and today AI is no longer a plaything. It's a business imperative. Your team spends half their time writing, and one confusing email can turn into 12 confused replies and a meeting to get back on the same page. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all the wasted time and money that goes with it. I have really found Grammarly to be super helpful to save time with generative AI prompts. It's also super easy to stay organized because Grammarly works great with other programs that I already use. Grammarly works everywhere you work and integrates seamlessly across 500,000 apps and websites. No cutting, no pasting, no context switching. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. You only get one chance to go public, and the stakes are high. Deloitte's free IPO readiness tool will help you grade your current state of readiness. Less than 10% of companies using Deloitte's free tool discover they're ready for an IPO. While the IPO market can be unpredictable, your company's readiness plan doesn't have to be. Don't miss your IPO window. Being ready starts with getting ready. With Deloitte's free and easy-to-use IPO self-assess tool, you can gauge your IPO readiness and receive tailored insights on 9 areas of focus in less than 30 minutes. Visit Deloitte.com/US/HIBT and launch your IPO journey today. Hey, everyone, and welcome to How I Built This Resilience Edition. This is where we've been talking with entrepreneurs about how to think creatively during this really disruptive moment. And in addition to a global health and economic crisis, we're also facing a longstanding racial justice crisis. The mass movements and demonstrations are opening up a whole series of conversations about race, justice, representation, and fairness. And you've probably been noticing companies, big and small, putting out statements in support of these conversations with pledges to take action. So today, we're going to hear from Yvonne Hutchinson. She's the founder of a consulting firm in the Bay Area called Ready Set. They help companies become more inclusive. Here's an excerpt from the live conversation I had with Yvonne earlier this week, which you can also watch at facebook.com/howibuiltthis. And just a quick note, there are a few moments where the internet connection gets a little glitchy, but it doesn't last too long. So first of all, how are you doing? I mean, we're in the middle of a global economic health crisis, mass demonstrations. The pace of change and the things that are coming at us is almost, it's overwhelming, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I talked to my mother the other day who was in Detroit during the 68 riots. And she was like, you know, this feels the exact same, but it also feels different because the people, the diversity of people out in the street look different, you know? And so in some ways, I think we're at a real precipice. You know, we're at a point where we could kind of push for revolutionary change right now, or we can not and deny the power of the moment that we're in. So I'm certainly hoping that it's the former.
Yvonne, as you know, the show is about entrepreneurs, and you came to the summit, and you are an entrepreneur. You are founder of a business called Ready Set. For people who aren't familiar with it, can you just tell us a little bit about Ready Set?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Ready Set is a high-touch boutique consulting firm. We really specialize in building human-centric management practices that embed diversity, equity, and inclusion throughout the business.
Like, walk me through a little bit about your approach. Like, when you are brought on by company to work with them, what are some of the things that you start to do?
I think very early on, we decided we wanted to be a little bit different. So just to kind of set the stage for you, when I started, companies were kind of in a place where some of them recognized diversity and inclusion were an issue, but many of them thought you could solve the issue with like a one-off training, like unconscious bias training, or, you know, these quick kind of ad hoc initiatives. And we saw that that didn't work. So we decided we were going to be very intentional about really providing an evidence-backed approach that was customized for the companies that we worked with. So we go in and we take a really close look at what's happening in their organizations. We talk to the people who work there. We look at their policies and processes, and we try to figure out what are some strengths this organization has for sure. How do we build off of those? But where are the gaps? Where are people falling through the cracks? Where is the culture coming apart? Where is there a lack of communication, a lack of transparency, et cetera? And then based on that, we craft our support for the organization. And that could look like a training, although that would be a training that's customized for them. Or it could be through the provision of advisory support, or it could be revamping, you know, from the top down, their policies, their processes, et cetera. It really depends on the client.
I mean, one of the things that is so clear and evident is that organizations that, you know, have the best of intentions to be diverse environments and to be inclusive environments and fall short of that need to have difficult conversations and need to have uncomfortable conversations. And human beings are kind of wired to avoid that, to avoid conflict, right? Most humans don't want to be in discomfort. It's why so many of us don't exercise, because exercise is uncomfortable. Bad analogy. But, you know, discomfort is, to me, it seems like we are in a moment where discomfort has to be front and center.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And I would say it even goes deeper than that. I think if you look at the history of work in this country, it's always been segregated, right? It's always been segmented. And so we're working within systems that weren't designed to be inclusive. So even if we have the best intentions, the organizations that we work for, how we structure them, who gets to advance, what's considered professional, how we prove our competency, all of those are biased in some way towards a certain kind of individual. And so we have to undo those biases. And that, and to your point, that process can be really, really uncomfortable. And at ReadySet, we like to say it's like a muscle. You don't, you know, we all think we can show up in a moment and be somebody's hero or say the right thing. But we've also all had that moment where we're in a uncomfortable or a weird situation and, you know, we leave it. And then 2 seconds later, we're like, oh, I should have said this, or I could have handled it this way. And that's natural, right? It's because fight or flight, and we're not always practiced in how to navigate it. And we don't want to disturb the relationships we have. So that is part of what ReadySet teaches folks to do.
You know, there's a lot of talk, as I mentioned, about diversity and inclusion, especially in Silicon Valley. You are based in the Bay Area, so you deal with a lot of these tech companies and VC companies. The vast majority of them are not diverse. There's an article in Wired in recent days. It was something like, I think between 2013 and 2017, out of all venture-backed founders, only 1% were African-American entrepreneurs. And let's be clear here, this is not for a lack of investment opportunities, right? I mean, there are plenty of Black entrepreneurs looking for funding, but they don't have the same connections or ins or networks or business school types or whatever it is at these VC firms, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's partially that. I also think that there's a lot of bias in VC. Like, we have Black entrepreneurs who go to the right schools, whatever that means, who, you know, have access to some of these networks. They also don't get funded. So I think in Silicon Valley, there's a culture of pattern matching, which is very limiting in a lot of ways. But when, you know, VCs picture the next Mark Zuckerberg, they don't picture a Black kid, you know, they don't picture a Black woman. A lot of times the people that they take a leap of faith on, that they invest in with just a slide deck. I think those days are long gone, but the people who they used to invest in with just a slide deck and an idea, they weren't Black. they looked like those VCs and they reminded those VCs of themselves. And so I think the pipeline and the in-network is part of it, but I think also a big part of it is just the bias towards a certain kind of entrepreneur that builds a certain kind of business.
You know, I know that you joined Black Tech for Black Lives. It's committed to a set of specific actions in the tech industry. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ideas, recommendations, proposals that you're putting forward?
Yeah. So I think Black Tech, Black Lives, it's about leveraging the Black community and allies in tech to push for social change and to create connections between us and the people on the ground, the people working in grassroots organizations, working with the city, the people who've done this work for years locally, so that we can leverage our privilege on their behalf. So we launched with a call to action, essentially, for Black folks and our allies in the tech industry. We really wanted people to move from words, because it's super easy to sign a pledge, to actually committing to do something. And so those action items that we suggested run the gamut from build more equitable tech companies, fund tech companies, supporting criminal justice organizations and organizations that are committed to accountability in the police. And what we're really trying to do is build something that feels holistic and informed by community activity. I think quite often it can be tempting for someone to see, you know, these marches and say, we're going to start our own thing. And there are people who've been doing this for a really long time. And I think the best use of our energy is support their work to build up Black folks locally. And that's the last thing I'll say about it, is that Black Tech for Black Lives is modeled around the idea that local action can be a catalyst for broader change. And so we're really focusing on Oakland and the San Francisco Bay Area. There are people who are interested in Tech for Black Lives in other parts of the country. We encourage them to use the action plan as a model and to work with the organizations in their cities as well.
When we come back in just a moment, if you're still wondering whether diversity training can really bring about meaningful change, Wyvonne tells a story of how she saw that happen. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This, Resilience Edition from NPR. Here on our show, we bring you tales of the long, sometimes really hard road to building a successful company. Of course, no two entrepreneurs' journeys are exactly the same, but themes do emerge. One, there's no way they can do it alone. Another is how incredibly important it is for companies to keep their teams connected, no matter where they are in the world. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone. Their team has spent over 20 years creating software like Jira and Confluence to make collaboration of any size and across any distance possible, because Atlassian believes the best ideas are impossible alone. And look, there will always be challenges with distributed work. Our team here at How I Built This might not be huge. We do a lot with a small group of hardworking people, but we really understand the importance of staying organized and having visibility across the team, especially when we're all working remotely. Having the right collaboration products can make all the difference when you need to move quickly, work efficiently, and make informed decisions. With their evidence-based approach, Atlassian has redefined collaboration for teams scattered across the globe. And if you're looking for solutions for your team, Atlassian's suite of software is the foundation to help make the way you work that much more seamless. No matter where you are, your team can plan meticulously with Jira and create a knowledge base with Confluence, turning ideas into action and brainstorming into breakthroughs. A world where distributed teams sync effortlessly, where the touch of innovation streamlines every project, that's not a dream. It's a reality with Atlassian. Whether your team is spread across the country or even the globe, delivering greatness is impossible alone. Learn more at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. I don't know about you, but I sometimes have a hard time finding just the right gift for a special occasion. Recently, I got the most amazing gift to mark a milestone on our show. I was sent a bottle filled with personalized M&Ms. And not only did they say HIBT on them, the other side had my face on it. My face is on hundreds of M&Ms. It is absolutely amazing. And it's given me an idea of what to send my nephew when he graduates college this year. M&M's has tons of graduation-themed packaging and party favor options for your personalized candy. I love the refillable Class of 2024 candy dispenser, which arrives pre-filled with custom M&M's. Honestly, it's super easy and fun to create personalized M&M's online. And when people see mine, they are such a hit that they might just be my new go-to gift to celebrate weddings, birthdays, anything. Visit mms.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's mms.com. Use code BUILT to receive 15% off your next order. This episode is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for building your brand, engaging your customers, and growing your business online. So if you're running a business like the founders on this show, then you'll love some of Squarespace's features. Whether you sell physical goods, digital content, or services, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online, including lots of payment options for customers at checkout, as well as easy client invoicing. Squarespace also makes email campaigns super easy with customizable email templates for converting subscribers into loyal customers. And Squarespace has tons of analytics so you know where all your site visits and sales are coming from. So check out squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/built to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This Resilience Edition. And we're talking with Yvonne Hutchinson about how companies can build more inclusive workplaces. Yvonne's consulting firm is based in the Bay Area, so she's worked with all types of companies from tech to healthcare. And as with all these conversations I've been having, we opened it up to the audience. And just a reminder, we're taking questions from Yvonne via Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, so please submit those questions. We have a question in from Will. He asks, in a group setting, in training, and maybe even in their own mind, people believe they are not racist, but then they still exhibit racist actions. And he asks, how do you balance a systemic approach and curb undesirable individual actions? Because it does, he says, it doesn't seem like diversity alone is enough.
Yes, he's absolutely right. That's a great question. I think, you know, we can start with training, but it doesn't end there. So I think self-education is important. To your point, understanding the ways in which we all are racist, understanding the way that systemic racism works. I work with organizations in the workplace. So we do training on systemic racism at work. What does that mean? How do we understand it? How does systemic racism affect who we hire, who we promote, the communities that we're embedded into, people's access to even getting to work? What does that mean? But I think that training itself is not enough. And if you really want to tackle systemic racism and you really want to engage in behavioral change, you have to have structures in place in your environment to incentivize the behavior you want and that address the structural gaps that you've identified. So for example, if you are, maybe you are getting Black people in the door, but they're not getting promoted and they're not in leadership positions. Well, something is wrong with how those people are being evaluated, the assignments that they're given, the mentorship and sponsorship opportunities they have, how they relate to their managers. And this stuff is not necessarily really easy to solve. It's a lot more difficult to look for this than it is to just survey your office and see how many Black people you have there, right? And individually, I would say, you know, a lot of times organizations talk the talk really well. We've seen so many great Black Lives Matter statements, and we've seen organizations that have really beautifully written values on their wall. And a lot of times those organizations are organizations that don't hold people accountable when they're harming other people, or they don't reward people who do the cultural and inclusion work at their office. And we know the behavior that gets rewarded and the behavior that gets punished or censored is what really forms the culture. You can say words all you want, you can go to all the trainings you want, but if there's no accountability around personal behavior and how we build relationships and how we live by our values, then those values aren't stick.
Yeah, I mean, and in an environment today where so many businesses, they use data for everything, you would think, and you can imagine that businesses can use data when it comes to diversity as well. I wonder whether you've encountered businesses and companies that actually evaluate and hold people accountable to the point where they are evaluated on their job performance based on promoting people of color and on hiring people of color and on having people of color in leadership positions around them, above them. Have you seen anything like that where the CEO is evaluated that way and the CFO and on down and middle managers and so on?
I've seen proposals for something like that. And I think we have to be really careful too, because sometimes those metrics can like push us into tokenism. I think the metrics to evaluate managers are, you know, pretty old and closely tied to traditional business outcomes. And while those can be valuable, they don't necessarily reflect all of the aspects of a manager's job. You know, a lot of what a manager does is work with people. So I think to answer your question, no, I've not seen companies do that. I've seen some proposals that would encourage organizations to do that, but I haven't really seen it in practice on the ground.
I know that you can't necessarily talk about specific clients that you've worked with, but have you had an experience with a company that's brought your team in where you actually have seen them walk the walk and talk the talk or begin to approach it that way?
Yes. I have a favorite experience, and this is like very, very close to my heart just because I used to work in public health internationally. But we work with a hospital system in the area, and, you know, no work environment's perfect. I'm not going to say that they're perfect. But what we did see is we saw a dramatic increase in the number of residents from underrepresented groups that went through the program. So when we started, it was something like 12%, and eventually it went up to something like 45%. We saw folks graduating who attended our sessions, who were then bringing our trainings to the hospitals that they were working in. We saw people having really deep conversations about racism and medical bias. And again, the culture in that organization, not perfect. They're in the middle of their transformation, but we've seen some really positive indication. And what I really love about this example is that, you know, this affects people's lives. When a doctor walks into a room and they're aware of their own bias, they're much less likely to treat a patient in a way that can negatively impact healthcare outcomes. So for me, that's the thing that I reflect back when I think about positive impact. That feels really, really strong for me. For other organizations that aren't necessarily healthcare organizations on the front lines, we work with a lot of tech organizations. You know, we do see some structural changes, some policy changes. The thing with this work, though, is that it's long and hard. We're seeing this now in the grassroots movement. And it takes time to affect sustained change. And I'm always very conservative about saying, you've done everything, you're right there. But we've certainly seen positive indication.
One of the crazy things about How I Built This is, you know, it's a show about entrepreneurship. And a lot of people don't know that actually entrepreneurship has been declining in the United States over the last 30, 40 years. And it's been particularly acute in the African-American community. I read an article in the Washington Monthly, came out a few years ago, and there's some really just very surprising statistics. Like in the, I'm looking at my notes here. In 1985, there were 60 black-owned banks in the United States. Today, there are only 23. In the 1980s, there were 50 black-owned insurance companies. Today, only two remain. A lot of this has to do with big companies consolidating, buying up smaller ones. A lot of it is basic lack of access to capital, to loans and investments. And I think this is a big part of the discussion, that the demonstrations that we're seeing aren't just about racial justice. They're also about economic justice because they're connected. Those things are connected.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when we think about entrepreneurship, particularly as it relates to Black folks, because I think when we look at larger Black businesses, that picture is right. I mean, we see consolidation, but we also know that like some of the fastest growing groups of entrepreneurs are Black, like Black women, fast growing group of entrepreneurs. But we also, our businesses tend to be smaller. We tend to hit a ceiling fairly quickly. We're not necessarily able to sustain over the long term. So I think to your point, you know, there's energy there. And I think a lot of people, a lot of Black people I've met who are entrepreneurs are actually saying, I chose this path because I no longer want to be in an environment where I feel like it's a racist environment, or I feel unsafe because of my race, or I can't advance because of my race. And that was my story. I left an organization that was incredibly harmful to my well-being. And I didn't realize that in part that was driven by racism until I stepped back and saw it. But I got lucky. I had people who were willing to back me, but I also had a lot of privilege. You know, you talk about those schools and those pipelines, guy, like I went to Harvard. So, you know, I was able to walk in a room and check somebody's box. Right. And a lot of Black entrepreneurs don't necessarily have that. And I think it's a missed opportunity as well. I think a lot of times economic justice is framed almost as charity. Right. When we see that the innovation happening in Black spaces, creative spaces, quite often is just not compensated in the same way that it is when it's done in non-Black and white spaces. I think there's some positive indications, like, I don't know if you've, how closely you stay on Twitter, but Publishing Paid Me, where people are, you know, doing the salary transparency around what their publishing deals look like, salary transparency within organizations, white people and non-Black people leveraging their privilege and giving folks just access to the information. Because quite often we don't know, you know, we don't know how much somebody's getting paid and how much somebody's right. getting funded. And that's part of the problem. I find those to be really, really encouraging.
I want to get to one more question from our audience before we wrap up. This is from Claire. She asks, what are some ways that organizations can amplify Black voices past the mic without bordering on tokenism or being performative?
That's a really great question. There are a lot of really good resources out there right now circulating in response to protests and the movement happening on the ground. I would first encourage organizations to look there. I think the challenge relying too much on the Black voices within your organization is quite often Black people do culture work, diversity and inclusion work, and a lot of emotional labor. So if tokenization is something you want to avoid, I think first doing that self-education. Second, and I don't say this out of self-interest, but bringing in an expert and accepting that the Black people in your org might not want to do or speak to some of the questions that you all may have around racism and how to improve your organization. But where you are relying on Black people to do that work is compensated. And those Black people are elevated as leaders and they're given power to make the changes that they're suggesting. I think a lot of us have kind of done this dance over the past few years where we're the first point of contact when something serious happens and we make a bunch of suggestions. A lot of them are ignored. We don't get promoted. We don't get any credit for that work. And we don't get access to leadership positions. And sometimes we're punished behind the scenes for saying the wrong thing. So I think you have to back up that quest for knowledge with rewarding the people who are saying, this is what we need to do to fix our culture. So those are some of the things that I would suggest. And I would finally say that this is long-term work. For us to really think about how we're leveraging this moment, it's going to require sustained effort. Yeah. And I think that is also where your business can really move from we're just talking the talk to we're walking the walk. We're investing over the long term and we're putting forth sustained effort.
Bhavan, thank you so much for joining us, for being here on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That's an excerpt from my conversation with Bhavan Hutchinson, the founder and CEO of ReadySet. To see our full interview, you can go to facebook.com/howibuiltthis. And if you want to see all of our past live interviews, you can find them there or at youtube.com/NPR. If you want to find out more about the How I Built This Resilience series or other virtual NPR events, you can go to nprpresents.org. This episode was produced by Candace Lim with help from John Isabella, Julia Carney, Gianna Capadona, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you right back here in a few days. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This from NPR.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. I'm Misha Brown, and I'm the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Every week, guests join me to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time, like who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize. They never imagined somebody might actually try to snag it, but a 23-year-old did, and suddenly Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now, I'm returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.